From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young with live coverage of the inauguration of George W. Bush. President Bush has just begun his inaugural address, welcoming those in attendance, saying he's grateful for the honor and mindful of the consequences of the oath he just took. Let's listen.
For as long as whole regions of the world simmer in resentment and tyranny, prone to ideologies that feed hatred and excuse murder, violence will gather and multiply in destructive power and cross the most defended borders and raise a mortal threat. There is only one force of history that can break the reign of hatred and resentment and expose the pretensions of tyrants and reward the hopes of the decent and tolerant, and that is the force of human freedom. We are led by events and common sense to one conclusion. The survival of liberty in our land increasingly depends on the success of liberty in other lands. The best hope for peace in our world is the expansion of freedom in all the world. America's vital interests and our deepest beliefs are now one. From the day of our founding, we have proclaimed that every man and woman on this earth has rights and dignity and matchless value because they bear the image of the Maker of heaven and earth. Across the generations, we have proclaimed the imperative of self-government because no one is fit to be a master and no one deserves to be a slave. Advancing these ideals is the mission that created our nation. It is the honorable achievement of our fathers. Now it is the urgent requirement of our nation's security and the calling of our time. So it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world. This is not primarily the task of arms, though we will defend ourselves and our friends by force of arms when necessary. Freedom, by its nature, must be chosen and defended by citizens and sustained by the rule of law and the protection of minorities. And when the soul of a nation finally speaks, the institutions that arise may reflect customs and traditions very different from our own. America will not impose our own style of government on the unwilling. Our goal, instead, is to help others find their own voice, attain their own freedom, and make their own way. The great objective of ending tyranny is the concentrated work of generations. The difficulty of the task is no excuse for avoiding it. America's influence is not unlimited, but fortunately for the oppressed, America's influence is considerable, and we will use it confidently in freedom's cause. My most solemn duty is to protect this nation and its people from further attacks and emerging threats. Some have unwisely chosen to test America's resolve and have found it firm. We will persistently clarify the choice before every ruler in every nation, the moral choice between oppression, which is always wrong, and freedom, which is eternally right. America will not pretend that jailed dissidents prefer their chains, or that women welcome humiliation and servitude, or that any human being aspires to live at the mercy of bullies. We will encourage reform in other governments by making clear that success in our relations will require the decent treatment of their own people. America's belief in human dignity will guide our policies. Yet rights must be more than the grudging concessions of dictators. They are secured by free dissent and the participation of the governed. In the long run, there is no justice without freedom, and there can be no human rights without human liberty. Some, I know, have questioned the global appeal of liberty. Though this time in history, 4 decades defined by the swiftest advance of freedom ever seen, is an odd time for doubt. Americans of all people should never be surprised by the power of our ideals. Eventually, the call of freedom comes to every mind and every soul. We do not accept the existence of permanent tyranny because we do not accept the possibility of permanent slavery. Liberty will come to those who love it. Today, America speaks anew to the peoples of the world. All who live in tyranny and hopelessness can know the United States will not ignore your oppression or excuse your oppressors. When you stand for your liberty, we will stand with you. Democratic reformers facing repression, prison, or exile can know. America sees you for who you are, the future leaders of your free country. The rulers of outlaw regimes can know that we still believe as Abraham Lincoln did. Those who deny freedom to others deserve it not for themselves, and under the rule of a just God cannot long retain it. The leaders of governments with long habits of control need to know. To serve your people, you must learn to trust them. Start on this journey of progress and justice, and America will walk at your side. And all the allies of the United States can know. We honor your friendship. We rely on your counsel, and we depend on your help. Division among free nations is a primary goal of freedom's enemies. The concerted effort of free nations to promote democracy is a prelude to our enemies' defeat. Today, I also speak anew to my fellow citizens. From all of you, I have asked patience in the hard task of securing America, which you have granted in good measure. Our country has accepted obligations that are difficult to fulfill and would be dishonorable to abandon. Yet because we have acted in the great liberating tradition of this nation, tens of millions have achieved their freedom. And as hope kindles hope, millions more will find it By our efforts, we have lit a fire as well, a fire in the minds of men. It warms those who feel its power. It burns those who fight its progress. And one day, this untamed fire of freedom will reach the darkest corners of our world. Few Americans have accepted the hardest duties in this cause. In the quiet work of intelligence and diplomacy, the idealistic work of helping raise up free governments, the dangerous and necessary work of fighting our enemies. Some have shown their devotion to our country in deaths that honored their whole lives, and we will always honor their names and their sacrifice. All Americans have witnessed this idealism, and some for the first time. I ask our youngest citizens to believe the evidence of your eyes. You have seen duty and allegiance in the determined faces of our soldiers. You have seen that life is fragile and evil is real, and courage triumphs. Make the choice to serve in a cause larger than your wants, larger than yourself. And in your days, you will add not just to the wealth of our country, but to its character. America has need of idealism and courage because we have essential work at home, the unfinished work of American freedom. In a world moving toward liberty, we are determined to show the meaning and promise of liberty. In America's ideal of freedom, citizens find the dignity and security of economic independence instead of laboring on the edge of subsistence. This is the broader definition of liberty that motivated the Homestead Act, the Social Security Act, and the GI Bill of Rights. And now we will extend this vision by reforming great institutions to serve the needs of our time, to give every American a stake in the promise and future of our country. We will bring the highest standards to our schools and build an ownership society. We will widen the ownership of homes and businesses, retirement savings, and health insurance, preparing our people for the challenges of life in a free society. By making every citizen an agent of his or her own destiny, we will give our fellow Americans greater freedom from want and fear and make our society more prosperous and just and equal. In America's ideal of freedom, the public interest depends on private character, on integrity, and tolerance toward others, and the rule of conscience in our own lives. Self-government relies, in the end, on the governing of the self. That edifice of character is built in families, supported by communities with standards, and sustained in our national life by the truths of Sinai, the Sermon on the Mount, the words of the Quran, and the varied faiths of our people. Americans move forward in every generation by reaffirming all that is good and true that came before, ideals of justice and conduct that are the same yesterday, today, and forever. In America's ideal of freedom, the exercise of rights is ennobled by service and mercy and a heart for the weak. Liberty for all does not mean independence from one another. Our nation relies on men and women who look after a neighbor and surround the lost with love. Americans at our best value the life we see in one another and must always remember that even the unwanted have worth. And our country must abandon all the habits of racism because we cannot carry the message of freedom and the baggage of bigotry at the same time. From the perspective of a single day, including this day of dedication, the issues and questions before our country are many. From the viewpoint of centuries, the questions that come to us are narrowed and few. Did our generation advance the cause of freedom? And did our character bring credit to that cause? These questions that judge us also unite us, because Americans of every party and background, Americans by choice and by birth, are bound to one another in the cause of freedom. We have known divisions which must be healed to move forward in great purposes, and I will strive in good faith to heal them. Yet those divisions do not define America. We felt the unity and fellowship of our nation when freedom came under attack, and our response came like a single hand over a single heart. And we can feel that same unity and pride whenever America acts for good and the victims of disaster are given hope and the unjust encounter justice and the captives are set free. We go forward with complete confidence in the eventual triumph of freedom, not because history runs on the wheels of inevitability. It is human choices that move events. Not because we consider ourselves a chosen nation. God moves and chooses as He wills. We have confidence because freedom is the permanent hope of mankind, the hunger in dark places, the longing of the soul. When our founders declared a new order of the ages, when soldiers died in wave upon wave for a union based on liberty, when citizens marched in peaceful outrage under the banner Freedom Now, they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled. History has an ebb and flow of justice, but history also has a visible direction set by liberty and the author of liberty. When the Declaration of Independence was first read in public and the Liberty Bell was sounded in celebration, a witness said it rang as if it meant something. In our time, it means something still. America in this young century proclaims liberty throughout all the world and to all the inhabitants thereof. Renewed in our strength, tested but not weary, we are ready for the greatest achievements in the history of freedom. May God bless you, and may He watch over the United States of America.
At this time, I'd like to present a very unique performance combining the United States Marine Band, the Navy Sea Chanters, and the Army Herald Trumpets, performing God of Our Fathers.
You have been listening to live coverage of the inauguration of George W. Bush, President of the United States, delivering his second inaugural speech, interrupted for just a few seconds there at the end, if you heard this over the radio, by what seemed to be a protester who was taken out of the area. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But first, we want to welcome our guests here in the studio and in Washington. We have Jim Nuzzo, Republican strategist, and George H.W. Bush's Deputy Director of Economic and Domestic Policy in the Reagan White House. Welcome, Jim.
Good to see you.
We also have Professor Julian Zelitzer. He's the history professor at Boston University who's visited us many times, and we welcome you back.
Thanks,
Professor.
For having me.
Peter Greer is with us in Washington. He's the Washington editor of the Christian Science Monitor. Hi, Peter.
Hello. Hello, everybody down in Boston.
Well, hello to you. And we're hoping to welcome Gail Chaddock. She is somewhere in that crowd, and we're going to go to her. She's your colleague, Peter, at the Christian Science Monitor. And when she emerges from the crowd, we heard she was in the oboe section somewhere, so we'll find her in just a moment. But I want to go to Jim Nuzzo. First of all, as we said, a Republican strategist watching very closely. Did the president say what you wanted to hear?
I think the president gave a sermon, gave a charge to the nation. What was quite remarkable for this was it was a traditionally almost Democratic-like speech. It reminded me of a President Wilson rather than Mr. Taft, who used to be in the old days Mr. Republican and isolationist. This was a speech that combined both realpolitik with Wilsonian Democratic idealism. I mean, he was speaking as if he was in a pulpit.
Well, in fact, Professor Zelitzer, jump in here about that comparison, because by my watch, I don't think he even mentioned domestic issues till about 14 minutes into the about 20-minute speech, and I counted the word freedom 25 times.
Absolutely. Look, this is a president who defined himself in the first term around 9/11, around the crisis of security that this nation faced, and I think he wants to make certain that that continues in the second term. That's the aura he wants to give. And at the very end, I think he tried to connect his foreign policy vision with his domestic policy vision. I think that will be trickier in the end.
Literally by saying that liberty can happen at home. I don't have the words right in front of me, but the broader definition of liberty is economic freedom.
I think what he's doing two things. One is he talked about the fact that there's no way for us to be a beacon of liberty in the world unless, one, we put our own house in order, and that's sort of taking care of unfinished promises. He talked about racism, for example, we needed to sort of cast off the baggage of bigotry. And then he also had a positive agenda, which is his ownership agenda, and that has a number of components. One is tax cuts. Second is the investment accounts in Social Security, large agenda items. He also said something which I thought was intriguing, which he's saying that he wanted to increase ownership of houses. And I'm sort of wondering as to whether we're going to see something which is going to make it easier for poor people to buy their apartments or other places where they're living so they can get an ownership stake in their society.
Peter Greer, I want to check in with you for just a second. In President Bush's first inaugural speech, in the very first line, he used the word liberator. Just a few lines in, he spoke about weapons of mass destruction and how he would seek and search them out. And others are reading that now as sort of flagging Iraq even before 9/11. Is there anything that you heard in here that you found interesting from a foreign affairs policy?
From a foreign affairs point of view, let me go back and start over with just my general reaction to this.
Sure.
Speech, and I can get to that in a sec. When I went through it first, as you guys probably did, I got a copy from the White House about half an hour ago, and I was reading it and making notes. The first thing I put down was vision thing. You know, you remember his father famously eschewed the sort of overall vision for the nation as pointless self-reflection. But his son surely seems to have learned that it has a certain unifying power in the nation. But and this point bears, I think, on your question. I also wrote down Iraq equals freedom, and then what happened to the WMD? ? You remember we went into Iraq, and much of the justification was to find weapons of mass destruction. We didn't find any. And now it becomes much more a effort to spread freedom around the world and to spread freedom throughout the Middle East, which was, you know, a less important justification prior to actual hostility.
Jim Nuzzo, I want to ask you to react to that because, you know, some would say that this is a speech that's sort of attempting to change history a little bit, or, you know, whitewash the reasons for going into Iraq and going to war?
I think what he's doing is putting it in a larger perspective. I mean, this has been George Bush's notion. That's why I say it had a charge or a sermon-like quality. It was Wilsonian. He basically sort of said the role of the United States is to bring freedom to everyone in the world. And, I mean, big changes. The old notion that we could sort of deal with China economically because it was in our interest and we could forget about the fact that the Chinese oppressed people. Well, if you listen to what he said, he basically said, if you treat your internal people badly, that will have a reflection on how we treat you diplomatically. This was sort of a global positioning of the United States in a massive historic front. I mean, it was almost Hegelian.
Well, and in fact, as you know, this is going to have reaction within the party. People like Pat Buchanan screaming, wait a minute, we can't be the world's policeman.
Absolutely. The fight, as I said before, the fight in the Republican Party has traditionally been between isolationists. That's the old Taft wing of the party. Well, basically what George Bush has said is, guys, there's no room for you in my party.
I want to talk more about what you think the reaction from the party might be, including the social conservatives in the party. And we also have Professor Zelizer here from Boston University. I want to get a sense more about the comparisons. But before we do that, and Peter Greer in Washington, you hold on as well, there's another story going on. We will talk about the heavy level of security in Washington. But interestingly, the focus has been on the security in Washington while there's a security story that has surfaced right here in Boston, Massachusetts. We want to check in with WBUR's Fred Tice. He attended a press conference this morning in Boston with Boston's mayor, Thomas Menino. And to fill our listeners in, Fred, this is because of an uncorroborated report that came in yesterday, apparently a phone call that tipped off the FBI that terrorists might be headed to the Boston area?
That's correct, Robin. This information came from federal officials yesterday, the Justice Department and the FBI, saying they had an identified source making an uncorroborated claim that four Chinese nationals were bound for Boston. According to Governor Mitt Romney of Massachusetts, these individuals were meant to stop in New York and then come on to Boston, and there was some sort of unspecified threat against the city of Boston.
Fred, I just have a few seconds left. How are officials treating this? Are they taking it seriously? In just a few seconds.
Mayor Menino today said that really he's not doing anything different today. Police is not looking for anything like a dirty bomb on the streets of Boston. There are no additional forces being deployed. He's urging people to remain calm. He is saying that much of this is sheer rumor.
And Governor Mitt Romney saying, I'm sleeping in my own bed tonight, so everybody relax. That's the message that we're getting from here in Boston. We're going to turn back to analysis of what's been going on in Washington, D.C., where President Bush has been sworn in today and delivered his inaugural address. We'll have more analysis and more of the feel of the very cold crowd there in Washington, D.C. when we come back. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. George W. Bush was sworn in for a second term as President of the United States just moments before noon East Coast time today. Mr. Bush is the 16th President of the United States to win a second full term, an accomplishment that was denied his father, George H.W. Bush, in 1992. He was on the podium today as his son was sworn in, along with the Bush family. President Bush promised to defend America whenever necessary and said freedom was a moral choice.
America in this young century proclaims liberty throughout all the world and to all the inhabitants thereof. Renewed in our strength, tested but not weary, we are ready for the greatest achievements in the history of freedom.
President Bush, Laura Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney and his wife, they have left the podium now, and they're now being followed by other former presidents, Bill Clinton making his way up through the crowd, who watched the inaugural ceremony this morning. Joining us in the studio here in Boston, Professor Julian Zelizer, a presidential historian at Boston University. Welcome back.
Hi.
And we also have Republican strategist Jim Nuzzo. And in Washington, we're joined by Peter Greer of the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome to you both as well.
Hello.
Hello there. And Julian, Professor, I want to start with you first because Jim Nuzzo was comparing President Bush's inaugural address today to Woodrow Wilson's. You had some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I do think the tone was very much like Woodrow Wilson's. It was an incredibly bold vision of what foreign policy should achieve. If there are any questions about whether Bush would temper himself after Iraq, this has clearly resolved it. But we should also remember that second term of Woodrow Wilson was a disaster. And I think Democrats have wrestled with Wilson's lessons about what foreign policy couldn't achieve ever since. And so I think there are a lot of similarities, not just in the rhetoric, but in the challenges that Bush would face. Second terms are pretty harsh on presidents, right, especially bold vision presidents.
Well, the beginning of this one was particularly harsh because it was very cold there in Washington, D.C. And before she freezes, we want to take a check in with Andrea Stone, a USA Today correspondent who's standing along Pennsylvania Avenue on the parade route. And Andrea, we know that protesters from the left and the right were expected to turn out today, turn their backs in one case. Have you seen anyone?
There's quite a few from the left. I only see a few anti-abortion protesters from where I am at 6th in Pennsylvania. A couple blocks down, there's several thousand anti-Bush people who are holding a rally and chanting and holding every kind of manner of sign you can imagine, not just against the war in Iraq, but, you know, in favor of gay rights, against in favor of the Palestinians. Every stripe of activist seems to be here.
Could you have a sense whether it's more or less than in past inaugurations? I know, you know, it's hard for you to see early on, but you have a sense of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know. I did talk to a former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who was in the protest crowd. He says it's the biggest crowd that he's seen. You know, the Park police don't give numbers or estimates of crowd numbers for political reasons now, because people always complain they're either too many or too little. So there probably won't be an official count. But I would say one thing there is at this hour, and we're still almost 2 hours from the, or less than 2 hours from the parade, there are apparently thousands of people who have backed up at the checkpoints to get into this area around Pennsylvania Avenue. Some of them are coming to see the parade or are Bush supporters. A lot of them are protesters, and there's been a lot of talk that there's been two-hour backups. So there may be a lot more people outside trying to get in.
Well, tell us about that, because the FBI is saying there's no place on the parade route that's not either assigned to ticket holders or to protesters. The group Answer, for instance, has taken out some space, the most of any protest group. But is there anyone who can just go see the parade who doesn't already have a ticket?
Well, you can, but there's not a whole lot of place to stand. I'm standing right at 6th Street. They're not, at least at this point, they're not letting people stand in the cross streets. And therefore, most of the avenue along the parade route is filled with bleachers that are will be filled in a while by people who have paid money to the inaugural committee. You know, there are a few open spaces, but compared to the bleachers, there's really not a lot of space.
Well, we mentioned some of the protests. There's a group that's planning to turn its back on the president along the parade route.
Yeah.
Another group is suing the National Park Service over public access. So the conservative groups, one was planning to carry crosses in defiance of the FBI. Any sense that they've done that?
I haven't, like I said, I've seen a few anti-abortion protesters. I haven't seen too many. I'm actually trying to make my way down Pennsylvania Avenue, which is not an easy thing to do. The security is so tight that to get across the street, you've got to go up the side streets and around, and it's starting to get crowded. So the access is not good for anybody, whether you support Bush or not.
Well, with that in mind, have you seen the Backbone Coalition? This is the group that's supposed to be carrying around a 70-foot display of a human spine to urge Democrats to stand up to Republicans.
I haven't seen that. I do have seen somebody posing as that Iraqi prisoner who was tortured, you know, the one with the wires attached to him. There's a lot of, you know, lots of handmade signs and all. But I haven't seen that. But again, you know, I'm in only one spot. It's very hard to get around, and I'm trying to make my way through the crowd to see what's going on.
Yeah. Andrea, one other question. We saw briefly a glimpse of a protester at the actual during the inaugural speech. It was very quick, but it looked as if someone was climbing up the to where President Bush was making an address. And the crowd obviously was cheering his being hustling out because it was an inappropriate time for them to be cheering the president. So that was our take on it. Do you have a sense of what that was?
No, I wasn't over there at the time. Mm-hmm. I will tell you, the people who plan to turn their back on Bush when he comes by in the parade, they are not carrying signs. They're not wearing anything that would identify them as protesters. So it's possible somebody was managed to get a ticket into the actual inauguration ceremony and got in that way. But there's a lot of people here who are not obvious protesters, and I think when Bush comes down Pennsylvania Avenue, we'll have a better sense of how many people will, literally turn their back on him.
And 4 years ago, the president's limousine was egged, an egg thrown at it. And it raises the question, this is the first presidential inaugural parade post 9/11. Any sense that he and Laura might, stop the car and get out and walk, which, has happened in the past?
I couldn't say, but, given the amount of police, there's police from every state here. The security is unbelievable. I find it hard to believe. I think the Secret Service would be pretty antsy about that. But, you never know. I can tell you one thing. It won't be near 4th Street, which is where the answer people are. He might want to do it closer to the White House.
Mm. Andrew Stone, correspondent for USA Today. One last thought. How cold is it for Washington?
Well, I think the wind chill is probably in the teens. I've got warm, there's a chemical warmer in my boots and in my gloves. I'm wearing two gloves, and it's pretty cold. I've been out here since 9 o'clock, and I want to get inside.
Well, Professor Zelitzer from Boston University, I'm reminded of, was it Harrison?
Mm-hmm.
Who had a very cold inaugural and then a month later died of the flu. So.
Yes, he gives the longest inaugural speech in American history, and he dies of the flu because of the cold.
Right.
So the prompt president will avoid that, I'm sure.
We're hoping that everybody stays warm.
Well, thanks a lot, Robin. I hope I don't die of the flu.
Andrea, thank you very much. Andrea Stone, correspondent for USA Today, along Pennsylvania Avenue, along the parade route. The parade will begin at about 2 o'clock. The inaugural speeches and the swearing-in are over, and the crowd seems to be gathering for lunch inside where it's warm. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now. We want to welcome back our studios here our guests here in the studio in Boston, Professor Julian Zelitzer, presidential historian at Boston University. Hello there.
Hi.
And Republican strategist Jim Nuzzo. And in Washington again, Peter Greer of the Christian Science Monitor. Peter, your sense of what the reaction to the president's inaugural speech is going to be from both Republicans and Democrats?
Well, earlier you were talking about his speech and comparing it to President Wilson's inaugural address. I'd like to move forward a little bit and compare it to JFK's inaugural address. And in that, and I will answer your question again in a moment get to the end of this thought. In JFK's address, he famously talked about, we will bear any burden, pay any price in the defense of freedom or liberty, if I remember that quote correctly, et cetera, et cetera. And the interesting thing about that is that he was using language with which you really can't disagree, or most Americans can't disagree, to make a particular policy point that was a much messier thing about which we could disagree. And because of famously, his administration really didn't support bear any burden in the defense of liberty. At home, they were a little recalcitrant on civil rights, for instance. But what he was saying was that we will contain the Soviet Union by virtually any means at our disposal. And I think President Bush was doing something of the same thing here, and that Democrats may pick up on that. He was using a very well-written speech, which makes points about which it is very difficult for any American to disagree, I think, to make the narrower point that we will try and spread freedom throughout the Middle East and that we will stay the course in Iraq. Because, for instance, on other nations around the world, does this mean now that we will press Saudi Arabia to be freer? Does it our relations with China are better than they have been in 3 or 4 years. Secretary Powell has said, the warming of our relations with China is a great unreported story. So I think really Democrats will pick up on that and hone in about what does this mean for the rest of the world? Is he really just saying this is about Iraq?
Yeah, Professor Zelitzer, he seemed to be saying, he did say, oppressed people, wherever you are, we will stand with you. Does that mean physically next to you in uniform?
Well, look, I mean, inauguration speeches are about kind of building the spirit of the nation around a policy, and they're inherently broad. So I don't think this means that the administration is going to follow through on everything it's implying in the speech. But I do think it will grant a certain legitimacy in their minds to what they do pursue. And it also puts the Democrats on a spot. It is a compelling argument. I mean, it's much more compelling to say we are fighting for democracy and freedom than stopping WMDs. And in some ways, Democrats need as bold an argument if they're going to take this back.
Well, I wondered, was it fear-mongering? I mean, there was a lot of first few words spoke of tyrants and violence around the world will be met. And we've been looking at lines from past speeches, Jim Nuzzo. FDR's "the only thing we have to fear is fear itself." I'm wondering if some critics would hear President Bush's speech today and say his version would be "the only thing we have to fear is not fearing." I mean, is that a fair criticism, or in a post 9/11 world, is that the only thing he could do?
I took a look at this, and I think rather than looking at either Wilson's speech or JFK's speech or indeed the 32 speech of Roosevelt, I think that Michael Gerson, who was the presidential speechwriter, this is his swan song, by the way. He had a double bypass and has now left the White House, but this was his swan song working with the president, really took this as sort of a riff off the Declaration of Independence. And the use of the word tyrant here, I think, harkens back to the use of the word tyrant in the Declaration of Independence. And he was basically saying, in the Declaration of Independence, because of God-given rights, we had the right to be free. Now we are going to essentially take this right that we have been given and that we have largely succeeded in the United States, and we are now going to become that beacon to bring it to the rest of the world.
Jim Nuzzo, I want to stay with you again, a Republican strategist. We were talking a little while ago about how some Republicans might object to that, you know, the isolationists in the party. Can we switch to social issues for just a second and get your thoughts on that? Did the conservative wing of the party hear what they wanted to hear?
Oh, they had one line. They had a bone that was tossed to them. If you go to the near end of the speech, there's a line in which he said, "We must always remember that even the unwanted have worth." And I read that as dealing with the unwanted babies or abortion.
We want to talk more about the social issues in the speech as they were mentioned. We'll do that when we come back. You are listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our coverage of the inauguration of President George W. Bush. President Bush's inaugural address was less than 20 minutes, and he said the word freedom 25 times. Freedom was the central theme. Let's listen to an excerpt.
"And as hope kindles hope, millions more will find it. By our efforts, we have lit a fire as well, a fire in the minds of men. It warms those who feel its power. It burns those who fight its progress. And one day, this untamed fire of freedom will reach the darkest corners of our world."
President Bush speaking just a while ago. And joining us in the studio here in Boston are Professor Julian Zelitzer, presidential historian at Boston University. Welcome back.
Thank you.
It's radio. You have to speak. Yeah. In Washington, we're joined by Peter Greer of the Christian Science Monitor. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
And we also have Republican strategist Jim Nuzzo, who corrects me. The word freedom was invoked how many times?
27.
So our counting was off. So either way, it was a lot. We want to talk to you more about the use of words. Was it a pretty speech? Get your thoughts on that. But first, we want to turn to Gail Chadwick from the Christian Science Monitor, who was in, I believe, the oboe section of a band during the speech and is now back in her office. Gail, hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine. Well, what did it feel like? What did the speech feel like from where you were? Where were you?
I was actually in the fourth row, just in front of the oboes. I had a bar right across the president's face, so I got to see the top of his head and his shoulders. It was mainly the experience of very large and enthusiastic crowds. It was like being at a Super Bowl with only one team.
He seemed to be really welcomed and appreciated, and there were others who were welcomed and appreciated as well. I mean, Laura Bush, when she came out, it seemed as if got almost as big an ovation.
Yes, that's what it felt like from where I was sitting.
And how did Chief Justice William Rehnquist look to you? He was ailing. He had a cane. As we know, he's been fighting cancer and was very closely watched today. How did he look to you?
From where I sat, I couldn't see a thing. So you're going to have to ask someone with the television. This was To be in the crowd is a little like that old joke about the elephant and the blind man. You know, you have a hold of the tail, but no clue about anything
right.
else.
You feel the trunk, and that's it.
Well,
from what we could see, he seemed to be just a little bit shaky, but determined. And we'll talk more about, you know, what this means, that he shows up at all.
He was there. That's
he was there.
Thing.
Right. But Gail, tell me, there was a moment, it seemed to us, it was quick, but it seemed as if there was a moment when a protester got close to the president, or there seemed to be a scrum immediately of police around him who took him away.
There was a scrum, but it wasn't close. It got nowhere near the section that I was in. What was interesting was the reaction to it, which was the crowd, you know, as he was carried out, he was shouting no, 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 and the crowd immediately going into chants of USA and chants of abortion and so forth. The protesters were kept very, very far away from this event, deliberately.
Right. And it seemed it was sort of the chance of the crowd against the protester did more to disrupt the president's speech than the protester seemed to. But, Gail, tell me your thoughts on the speech itself.
I thought the most interesting image was where he was talking about years of quiet repose, sabbatical, and suddenly there came a day of fire. And then at the end of the speech, getting back to the fire of freedom as a metaphor that kind of carried it through. Clearly, freedom was the theme. It was full of, the day was full of symbolism. One of the things we in the press have learned in covering this president is that a lot of what he says isn't designed for the national media. For example, the choice of a song early on that John Ashcroft had written, probably not many in the national media knew that, but many in the audience did. That's Let the Eagle Soar. And I think a lot of the, instead of, you know, making a direct reference to abortion, you know, making references to even the unwanted have worth, a lot of religious symbolism in this day, in its choice of music and in its choice of words.
Well, Gail, I was going to ask you that because in his first speech, he made mention, he said, if we see the wounded traveler on the road to Jericho, we won't pass him by. And I thought at the time, not everyone's going to know that's the story of the Good Samaritan as told by Jesus in the Bible. Did you hear, you know, tell us other religious references that might have been off some people's radar that you might have heard?
Oh, I should go back and look at my notes about that. But they were, the speech is riddled with them. You know, little bits from Isaiah and.
But was it, and as we round out the hour, I want to ask all of our guests, was it a good speech? Was it a pretty speech? Was the use of words? There was one phrase that I liked. We'll put our, our response came. Will come like a single hand over a single heart. That seemed like a pretty line, but. Was there a memorable line, one that resonates, Professor Zelitzer, one that's going to jump out and resonate?
My first answer is it's hard to tell at this point. Part will depend on what he does in 4 years. We look back at these speeches and we see what happened afterwards rather than just the speech.
So ask not what you can do for your country didn't resonate till later?
Not like it does today. Huh. I think part of it is the Peace Corps. I think part of it is what Kennedy tried to accomplish afterwards. I think there is a line, the public interest depends on private character, which I think if Bush can move forward with the domestic ideas he has, he can really transform the role of government in curtailing it. And that might be a line that resonates, and I don't think a lot of people picked up on it right now.
Jim Nuzzo, GOP strategist, your thoughts?
The line that I think, if there's one sort of pretty line in the speech, it's again towards the end in the peroration where he goes, "We have confidence because freedom is the permanent hope of mankind, the hunger in dark places, the longing of the soul." I mean, you know, what's amazing is if you took a look at this man's speeches 4 years ago, they were made very, you know, every sentence was very short. They were not pieces of beauty. This, I think, is a speech which will hold up both as a visual piece and as an oral piece in the years to come. I agree with the professor. You know, talk is cheap, action's dear. But as a piece of rhetoric, this is a lovely piece of rhetoric, and I think far better than even those of us who like the president thought he was capable of pulling
off. I think whether you like him or hate him, it is a president who has grown into the presidency, and I do think this speech reflects that. This is a man with now a vision and a voice where he didn't have one before.
Peter Greer of the Christian Science Monitor, we've got about a minute and a half. Can you weigh in as well?
I think that as a piece of writing, as a professional writer myself, I thought it was extremely well done, one of the best of these sorts of things that I have seen in my 25 years in Washington. And I'll, in fact, read the context. I also underlined the line that you mentioned, and if you don't mind, I'll read the context of that. He said, "Yet those divisions do not define America." And he's speaking about September 11th here. "We felt the unity and fellowship of our nation when freedom came under attack, and our response came like a single hand over a single heart."
Mm. And Gail Chadwick, did you like the line? Or with this consciousness that you have in the speech in general of some of the veiled comments, you know, what are your thoughts?
I still like the line he cribbed from Lincoln: "No one is fit to be a master, and no one deserves to be a slave." I don't think you get much better than that.
That's Gail Chadwick from the Christian Science Monitor, who spent a chilly morning sitting in front of, well, the president's shoulder, which he could see at the inauguration. We also were speaking with Peter Greer of the Christian Science Monitor, Jim Nuzzo, GOP strategist, and Julian Zelitzer, a historian professor at Boston University. We want to thank you all for coming by and helping us do some sort of post-game analysis of today's events in Washington. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Certainly.
And thank you for listening. And stay tuned to your NPR station, because analysis and coverage will continue. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's Inauguration Day in the United States. Minutes before noon East Coast time in the nation's capital, George W. Bush was sworn in for his second term. The president said America is led by events and common sense to one conclusion: the survival of liberty in our land depends on liberty in other lands.
And as hope kindles hope, millions more will find it. By our efforts, we have lit a fire as well. A fire in the minds of men. It warms those who feel its power. It burns those who fight its progress. And one day, this untamed fire of freedom will reach the darkest corners of our world.
The president never mentioned Iraq specifically. Instead, he spoke of the role the United States plays in fostering freedom around the world.
Our country has accepted obligations that are difficult to fulfill and would be dishonorable to abandon. Yet because we have acted in the great liberating tradition of this nation, tens of millions have achieved their freedom. And as hope kindles hope, millions more will find it. By our efforts, we have lit a fire as well. A fire in the minds of men. It warms those who feel its power. It burns those who fight its progress. And one day, this untamed fire of freedom will reach the darkest corners of our world. Few Americans have accepted the hardest duties in this cause. The quiet work of intelligence and diplomacy, the idealistic work of helping raise up free governments, the dangerous and necessary work of fighting our enemies. Some have shown their devotion to our country in deaths that honored their whole lives, and we will always honor their names and their sacrifice.
Further, the president said that in defending freedom around the world, the public interest depends on private character.
Self-government relies, in the end, on the governing of the self. That edifice of character is built in families, supported by communities with standards, and sustained in our national life by the truths of Sinai, the Sermon on the Mount, the words of the Quran, and the varied faiths of our people. Americans move forward in every generation by reaffirming all that is good and true that came before, ideals of justice and conduct that are the same yesterday, today, and forever.
President Bush speaking this morning at his inaugural. He spoke for less than 20 minutes and invoked the word freedom 27 times. How is it being received? In the studio, we're joined by Jim Nuzzo. He's a Republican strategist, a contributor to the National Review Online, and George H.W. Bush's Deputy Director of Economic and Domestic Policy in the Reagan White House. Welcome, Jim.
Good to see you.
We're also joined by Professor Julian Zelitzer. He's a history professor at Boston University, author of On Capitol Hill, The Struggle to Reform Congress and Its Consequences, 1948 to 2000. Welcome, as usual, Professor.
Thanks for having us.
And from Washington, we're joined by Peter Greer, Washington editor for the Christian Science Monitor. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
And Peter Canellos, Washington Bureau Chief of the Boston Globe. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Robin.
So we got two Peters there. We'll have to have to work with that. But let's start with you, Jim Nuzzo, the Republican strategist first. Were you happy? Did you like it?
You know, I thought it was a 10 strike for what this man who has for so long been denigrated as not a good speaker. This was a sermon. This was a charge. It had poetry. It had rhythm to it. I think it had phrases that are going to renown not just in the next news cycle, but are going to be in the history books. He basically gave a Wilsonian speech. He said, the idea of America is advancing freedom, and that's what our job is going to be doing, finishing the job at freedom at home, advancing it abroad. It was as an idealistic speech as you could have ever heard any president give.
And was it one that you'd expect from a Republican president?
Well, you know, there's always been a lot of here and back with Republicans regarding the role of the United States in the world. The old Mr. Republican, Robert Taft, was Mr. Isolationist. And right now that wing of the party is Pat Buchanan's. And what he basically is saying to Buchanan is, you have no role as a Republican. We are internationalists. We are going to be not just doing it for realpolitik reasons, but we're doing it for idealistic reasons. They both line up and make us want to do this. I thought one of the most interesting lines is when he basically said, if you are oppressing people at home, that will have consequences with your relationship to us. Mm-hmm. And that is a real sort of blow to the business as usual types, the businessmen who want us to turn our back upon tyrants.
Peter Greer, listening in Washington, your thoughts, especially on that part of the speech, the president did seem to say, if you are oppressed, we, the U.S., stand with you.
That's true, and I think you have to give him some latitude for rhetorical flights that do inspire the nation. But as I said earlier, for instance, in China, which by some accounts does oppress many of its citizens, is a nation with which we've been improving relations. Mm-hmm. And I don't foresee that we're going to be going the other way in the next 4 years. So I think that that's a charge which will be perhaps implemented selectively.
Yeah. Professor Zelitzer, Jim Nuzzo said it was Wilsonian. You've given some thought to Wilson. Your thoughts, how does the President Bush's speech compare to past speeches?
I think it's a great speech in terms of placing himself in a broader context, which is what a second-term inauguration speech should do. I think by embracing Wilsonian goals, he will also inherit Wilsonian problems. President Wilson's second term was very tough, and it goes down in many ways in defeat. I also think there's a fundamental tension in his talk, which is a tension Republicans are wrestling with. On foreign policy, he's calling for an aggressive government that will do things that have not been done before. And on domestic policy, he's saying we need private character over public interest, which is a turn away from government. And the two don't necessarily jive.
He didn't even get to domestic issues. Peter Canellos is going to bring you in. He didn't even get to the domestic issues till about, by my watch, about 17 minutes into the speech.
Well, certainly, you know, this speech was meant as sort of a ratification of his speech right after September 11th, 2001, his much-praised speech about 2 weeks after the terrorist attacks. And, you know, this is a deeper and in many ways amplified statement along the same lines as that speech. The one thing that is the unusual point of connection or perhaps disconnect in both of those speeches is that he's ascribing the motives of the terrorists who attacked the United States to their hatred of freedom, and that the cure for the threat of terrorism is spreading freedom. And he has proclaimed that and announced that and declared that so many times, and yet there are a lot of people, more obviously abroad than in the United States, that fear that may not be the correct theory of the case, you know, that terrorists may in fact hate the United States because it's rich, not because it's free.
Well, in fact, Peter Greer, I just want to pull you in for a second. You noted to us earlier that this is not even the reason that we went to war in Iraq.
Or at least that was not the reason that was the primary one used to justify it before the war. The real reasons we went to war will be coming out, of course, over many years to come. But I think that Peter makes a very interesting point, and to kind of amplify that, I'll return to your comment. You said you used the word freedom, what, 27 times. Mm-hmm. I've been going through trying to find the word democracy, and I think I found one use of it as a noun, Democrats with a small d. And that's it. Freedom is a large word which many people can interpret differently. For instance, Peter's correct to say not everyone thinks freedom in the terms of voting at the ballot box is what's necessary. But others say what we really need to do to stop terrorism is to spread wealth around the world, you know, freedom from want, perhaps, to connect nations to the global economy. So what he's really used is, again, an inspiring thing that many people can see many different ways.
Yeah. Jim Nozzo, I mentioned this to you as we were listening to the speech that, you know, we were looking at lines from past speeches, and FDR's comes to mind, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. I can hear a critic saying President Bush's line might be, with, you know, some of the saber rattling at the top of the speech, speaking of tyrants and violence, his line might be, the only thing we have to fear is not fearing. Was it fear-mongering, or does he have any other choice post-9/11? What are your thoughts?
Well, Robin, before I get to that, just to help Peter out, because I always know that he would like to get help in this regard, here's just two times in which, and I just looked at it for a second, the word democratic was used. So does the policy of the United States seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in the world? And then later he writes, democratic reformers facing repression, prison, or exile can know America sees you for who you are, the future leaders of your free country.
That's still 2 to 27. 27 for the word freedom.
No, I agree. Yeah. But I mean the idea of democratic. I mean, I think we have to recognize that the president isn't just doing a marker on what has been. This is a forward-looking speech. I don't even think it was a speech dealing even that much with terrorism.
But did he balance fear with hope? I mean,
yes. I mean, I think the whole thing is hope. I mean, listen to that last line. You know, America sees you for who you are, the future leaders of your free country. He's speaking to them saying, have hope. You will be free. We will help make you free. I thought this was an incredibly helpful speech.
You know, we're going to ask you each later if you thought, more about what you thought about the words and phrases and if one jumps out. But before that, Peter Kanellis, I want to pull you back in. The domestic issues were only touched on in a few minutes. What did you hear there? What jumped out at you?
Well, certainly the disparity between foreign policy and domestic policy jumped out, and it was a little bit of a surprise to people in Washington, because people in Washington have been impressed and surprised by the extent of Bush's aggressiveness on domestic issues just in the last month or so. The president has an unusually ambitious second-term domestic agenda, starting with Social Security, which is, you know, a huge, epic program, and he's proposing a very radical change. And so the fact that proportionally less of this address was devoted to domestic affairs was a little bit surprising. I think we'll see a difference in the State of the Union speech, which will be more heavily domestic.
Peter Greer, did the social conservatives in the Republican Party hear what they wanted to hear in the speech about abortion, gay marriage?
Well, I think it was Jim Nusso who earlier made the point that there was one line in the speech which he felt was, in essence, a somewhat coded reference to the rights of the unborn. Beyond that, I felt that what this speech was, as we've been saying all along, was Wilsonian and inspirational. And you know, that's not directly addressed at the conservative wing of the Republican Party. This was a speech which was not meant to satisfy them so much as it was meant to inspire and rally the entire nation. And mm-hmm. I think you'll see that in the rhetorical tropes that he uses.
And Professor Zelitzer, we just have a few seconds. We're going to have you back at the end of the hour to get more of your thoughts. But, you know, what are you thinking right now?
I do think, though, on domestic policy, this whole idea of an ownership society, of individual choice, is some kind of a framework to sell conservatism to the center, to Democrats who are unhappy with their party, and to moderate Republicans who have not heard their voice in the administration. And I think there's something there that needs to be looked at pretty seriously.
Well, in fact, we are going to take a look at Social Security in particular. The president says he wants to fix Social Security. Many say it's not broken. And then we'll talk more about the speech, the festivities, the cold in Washington, D.C., with our many guests we've got lined up. Stay there. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our analysis of this morning's inauguration procedure, President Bush's speech, his swearing in, thousands who crowded the mall in Washington to witness it. And we're speaking with Jim Nuzzo, a Republican strategist, and has been pretty active in White House affairs. So we welcome you back, Jim.
Good to see you.
And Professor Zelitzer, who's a history professor at Boston University, the author of many books, including one called Taxing America, about Social Security. So we're about to begin a conversation on Social Security. And did the president mention it directly?
No, but I think there was, when he's talking about opportunity, there might have been an indirect mention of investing on your own.
And the ownership society.
The ownership society is a code, really, for Social Security reform. It's a funner way to say it.
Well, let's bring into the conversation now Marilyn Moon. She's vice president of the American Institutes for Research and expert in Social Security and Medicare. Welcome.
Thank you.
And as you know, I've sort of been characterizing it in just one line. It's much broader than that. But in that one line, President Bush has been saying he wants to fix a broken Social Security system. Others, including many lawmakers and economists, say it's not broken. So we've got two debates going on, one, how to fix it, and one, it's not broken. Can you just explain, in headline form, what those arguments are?
I think essentially the arguments are that by the people who say it's not broken, say that most of them will say that things do need to be adjusted, but you can do minor adjustments and solve the problem, as well as do the privatization accounts. And in fact, the privatization or the private accounts that they talk about would be more expensive over time than some of the other fixes that people talk about that are more modest.
Mm-hmm.
The people on the other side want to establish the ability of individuals to control part of the resources that now go into a large pool in which both the gains and risks of society are shared.
Yeah. Now, you served on the Social Security Trust Fund. You're familiar with the fund's fiscal health.
Yes.
Do you think it needs a complete overhaul, privatizing?
No, I don't. Yeah. I think that should be dealt with as a totally separate issue. That's a decision that you can make in terms of restructuring the program. But I think it's a false claim to say that it's so broken that only this will fix it, which is a kind of way of making people accept something they might not otherwise accept.
Right. Well, I want to bring in Jim Nuzzo again and our professor here and ask each of you. Jim, again, the Republican strategist, There are people who are increasingly disagreeing with the president's notion that the system's even broken. So what happens here?
Well, I think you have to understand several things. One is that the president sees this as an opportunity to do a radical transformation of Social Security. Remember when Social Security came in the 1930s, early 40s, the whole idea was that it was supposed to be a stopgap program. It wasn't to be the only way in which you were going to be able to take care of your retirement needs. Unfortunately, over the years, it has taken on more and more of that sort of role. And unfortunately, the percentage of money that people are going to get back and need in order to have a long life, almost a second life, just makes it impossible to act. The president says, look, let's go and try to do something much more bold. Let's try to turn this into the retirement fund for the nation. And here's the political fact. People who own stocks 59% of them approve of the president. People who don't own stocks, 44% of them approve of the president. The more people who become owners of society, in a sense, own stocks either directly or indirectly, the larger the Republican Party stands to gain, same way in which for years and years it was the people who received Social Security that were the backbone of the Democratic Party.
But Professor Zelitzer, you know, this could be risky business, as you know, politically. Could this do to President Bush and the Republicans what health care reform did to the Democrats, and in the short time that a lame duck president has?
Absolutely. Look, second terms are notoriously dangerous, and taking on Social Security today, especially after a shaky stock market period, can be a political disaster. It could be a great success or a political disaster. And I think a lot of Republicans are nervous about that, especially those who have presidential ambitions and those who are going to outlive Bush politically. They are nervous about this. Bush needs 60 votes in the Senate, and I don't know if he has that.
And Marilyn Moon, I'm wondering, you know, people who support him would say that President Bush is absolutely sincere about this, but there are others who are already saying that this is the weapons of mass destruction of this second term, that, you know, the problem doesn't exist.
Well, I'd like to see us separate the two issues and be honest with people on both sides of the aisle. I think that means that Democrats have to admit that there are things that will need to be done to the program that cause some pain, and Republicans have to admit that as well. If they want to do privatization, that's over and above other things that are needed. You have to do something to adjust moving into the future no matter what. And so far, this privatization debate gives both sides cover and not without actually addressing the real problems head on.
Yeah, Marilyn Mamoon is a vice president of the American Institutes for Research and a former Social Security trust fund trustee. And Jim Nuzzo, in the minute or so we have left, he didn't say the two words, Social Security, in the speech today. Is that probably par for the course? I mean, he does have a State of the Union speech down the road.
Well, that's right. I mean, remember that the one which typically is sort of the grab bag of all the goodies is the State of the Union, which will be coming up. But he did say the words retirement savings and did say health insurance. So he actually came pretty close. But you're going to be seeing a grab bag. State of the Union happens in a couple of weeks. That's when all the domestic agenda will be laid out.
Yeah. Jim Nuzzo is a Republican strategist. We're also joined by Professor Zelitzer, who is both a historical a history professor, a presidential historian, and an expert on this issue. Do you think this issue is going to wane?
No, I don't think it's going to wane, only because President Bush is such a determined president. He does not let politically dangerous issues stop him. And I don't think he's going to let Social Security stop him. I do think it will be a difficult, if not a failed policy for him. I'm not sure it's a smart choice, but he'll do it. He'll push for it.
Okay, we're going to talk a lot more about Social Security tomorrow on Here and Now, so be sure to tune in for that. Marilyn Moon, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And when we come back, we're going to be talking about so many more issues that are of the day, including security in the nation's capital and, to many surprise, right here in the city of Boston with an uncorroborated threat of terrorism. There's more coming back. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Security in Washington, D.C. is, of course, very tight for today's presidential inauguration. But another security concern is in the news today. An anonymous tip alleges that a group of six people crossed into the U.S. over the Mexican border with the intention of detonating a so-called dirty bomb somewhere in Boston. Here now, Fred Tice has been covering the story. He joins us from his desk at the Massachusetts State House. And, Fred, this has, of course, got the city very much on edge.
Yes, it does, Robin. Ever since the first reports came out yesterday that there were these people who were bound for Boston with reports that rumors, really completely unsubstantiated rumors, that they may be setting off a dirty bomb.
Based on an uncorroborated phone call, a tip, and an anonymous one as well. But first of all, remind us, what is a dirty bomb?
Well, a dirty bomb is a radiological weapon. It could be as simple as something as a dynamite stick with some kind of radioactive material attached to it. So any kind of radioactive material attached to an explosive, it is by no means a nuclear weapon. It is nothing nearly as powerful as a nuclear weapon.
There are phrases coming in the papers today, you know, it may not kill a lot of people, which is not a lot of solace to people. Mayor Menino held a press conference this morning. Governor Mitt Romney, a rising star in the Republican Party, left the inaugural events last night, flew back to Boston. He's going to be meeting with the press at 2 o'clock East Coast time today. They seem to be taking it seriously while also telling people to go about their business.
Yes, exactly. They're saying that the information is very specific about four individuals. These other two individuals, that seems to be a rumor. Four individuals of Chinese nationality who have been identified. There are pictures of them. Because the information is that specific as to these four people, and also that the call had made some sort of reference to a potential threat against Boston, and specifically mentioned Boston, also mentioned that the individuals had been dropped off in New York. They thought, the officials think that it's, you know, there's enough there to pay some attention to this.
Right. And then the faces of these Chinese nationals, pictures are splashed all across the papers. Any sense that they are truly the people involved, and they're supposed to be some sort of scientists from China?
Well, there's no confirmation from any official source that these people are scientists. The only information we have from the FBI and the Justice Department, who put out this bulletin, is that there are four Chinese nationals. And there's really no way of telling what the citizenship of these people are. They just appear to be, you know, of Chinese descent.
Now, Governor Mitt Romney made a point of making a statement saying he was going to sleep in his own bed tonight, which might not have resonated across the country. People might wonder, well, where else would you sleep? But there is a bunker in Massachusetts where officials are supposed to go in the event of an emergency. He's obviously sending a clear signal he's not going there.
Oh, yes, absolutely. But I think he was also referring to the fact that much as he wanted to be in Washington last night for the presidential inauguration and all the festivities, and again tonight, he felt that he had to come home, mainly, he says, to show that it's safe to be in Boston. And that's why he says he's going to be in his own bed. He says also he's here in the very remote chance that he might have to make some decisions regarding this supposed terrorist threat.
Here now, reporter Fred Tice speaking from his desk at the Massachusetts State House. Fred, thanks so much.
You're very welcome, Robin.
Well, as is the nature of such speeches, the president spoke in broad strokes about the need for democracy and liberty around the world. But what about the details? Look at what sort of national security and defense policy we might expect from a second Bush term, and what signals specialists might have heard in the speech. We're joined by Thomas Barnett in Newport, Rhode Island. He's a security analyst and author of the Pentagon's new map. He was until very recently with the Naval War College. Welcome, Thomas.
Thanks for having me.
And also we welcome back John Diamond, USA Today, intelligence community correspondent. John, welcome.
Good to be here.
And what did you hear in the speech, Thomas? We were talking earlier about how it seemed to signal around the world that the U.S. is going to stand up to those who would oppress anywhere around the world. What exactly do you think the U.S. is capable of doing?
Well, I think whenever you look around the planet and you're asking yourself, where are the key points of oppression or as he describes them, tyranny, you're going to have to take into account, one, the load capacity of what we can manage. Obviously, we're bogged down to a certain extent in Afghanistan and in Iraq, so to the extent we can disengage from Iraq, that allows for greater possibilities. But I think we're probably going to be pretty much focused on the Middle East for the next 4 to 5 years. So I think the focus of this administration is probably going to be more on Iran than anybody else, despite the soaring rhetoric.
And John Diamond, the president's inaugural speech came as Boston and New York had this sort of uncorroborated threat of terrorism. So big consciousness of security at home.
Yes, he mentioned the work of intelligence officials in the speech, which I'm pretty sure is a first for an inaugural address. So there's certainly a consciousness of the role of the intelligence community in coping with threats to the homeland. I was interested in his remark that America's influence in the world is not unlimited, but it is considerable. And there seemed to be both a recognition that of limits to power. I mean, here we are in a war in Iraq where it's clear that the military is tapped to the max, just fulfilling the obligation it has there in that one country. and let alone taking on some massive new operation in Iran or some other part of the world.
Right.
And
speaking of Iran, Tom Barnett, you wrote a somewhat flip article in Esquire magazine with some serious thoughts about what you think the president should do to remake the world. And one of the thoughts, co-opt Iran.
Yeah, my argument there is that I can't imagine a stable Middle East 5-10 years from now where Iran isn't a serious security partner, because in effect they can veto peace both in Jerusalem and in Baghdad. I think Iran's obviously reached for the bomb. That was a decision we basically made when we decided to take down the Taliban to their east and Saddam to their west, incidentally benefiting Tehran in both instances, in effect making a brand new friend. So when Iran reaches for the bomb under those conditions, I think we've basically made that choice historically, and the question now has to be, what are we going to get out of Iran having the bomb? Because if Iran gets the bomb, which I think it's going to get, and we don't get anything in the process, then it's definitely a lose-lose.
Yeah, and Thomas Barnett goes on to say, in addition to co-opt Iran, lock in China, and then finally address North Korea, take down Korea, if you will. John Diamond, your thoughts, are any of those countries on the horizon for this administration?
Well, I'm getting some crosstalk on the line, but you're asking me about North Korea?
Right.
Yes, North Korea is another major challenge. It's perhaps a notch below Iran on the Bush administration priority list because it's not in the Middle East, but it is potentially an exporter of technology, of weapons of mass destruction, and therefore a major concern. When you have the administration talking about spreading freedom, spreading democracy, ending tyrannies, etc., you quickly bump up into the problem of the need on the part of this administration to ask for the cooperation of countries like China, which are not democratic, in dealing with problems like North Korea. So it's hard, on the one hand, to be aggressively pushing a freedom agenda in countries such as China while you're also asking their help in dealing with a situation like a threat like North Korea.
Well, by my count, the president's speech today addressed foreign policy issues for about 17 minutes and domestic for only about 3. So obviously he's putting that on the front burner. John Diamond of USA Today and Tom Barnett, a security analyst until recently with the Naval War College. Thanks for a quick look ahead at what the president might be confronting and how he might confront it. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing with our coverage and analysis of the inauguration of President George W. Bush. His inaugural address was packed with multiple references to freedom and liberty and to God. He spoke also of the importance of the nation's allies in achieving his global goals.
And all the allies of the United States can know, we honor your friendship, we rely on your counsel, and we depend on your help. Division among free nations is a primary goal of freedom's enemies. The concerted effort of free nations to promote democracy is a prelude to our enemies' defeat.
President Bush speaking shortly after noon East Coast time in his inaugural address, where we're joined again by Jim Nuzzo, a Republican strategist, a contributor to the National Review Online, and George H.W. Bush's Deputy Director of Economic and Domestic Policy in the Reagan White House. Welcome back.
Good to see you.
And also Julian Zelitzer, professor of history at Boston University, author of many books, and a presidential historian. And we're also welcoming Joe Klein, a senior writer of Time magazine. Joe, hello.
Hi, how are you, Rob?
I'm good. I'm good. And, you know, both Professor Zelitzer and Jim Nuzzo told us earlier they thought it was a very well-written speech. Your thoughts on the speech?
Well, yeah. I mean, Mike Gerson, who wrote this in collaboration with the president, I might add, is, you know, just a first-rate speechwriter. And it was a beautifully written speech, but it was a very defiant one. And you know, I have really mixed feelings about it because I love hearing the president talk about ideals like freedom and liberty. But, you know, the world is more complicated than that. And we're facing, you know, a very stern test in Iraq right now. And I think that in some ways it was a very short-term speech because he wanted to send a message to Iraq that we were going to stand with the forces of freedom there. And also a very long-term speech. It was a speech for legacy, for history. You know, when you talk about the message to our allies, my response is kind of define allies, because there is a sentence in here: the leaders of governments with long habits of control need to know. To serve your people, you must learn to trust them. Start on this journey of progress and justice, and America will walk at your side. Well, that seems to me to be a very pointed comment directed right at Hosni Mubarak in Egypt and the royal family of Saudi Arabia and others.
You said very saber rattling in a way. And I mentioned earlier to Jim Nuzzo, a Republican strategist, that if you think of the FDR line, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Some could say that President Bush's version might be the only thing we have to fear is not fearing, either at home of violence abroad or abroad of the U.S. You didn't like that, Jim.
Well, I thought that it wasn't a fear speech. This was a speech of hope. I mean, this was a speech in which he was basically talking to not only the American people, but also to people abroad, sort of saying, America is going to be that beacon. You had asked once before, Robin, what are the religious sort of connotations? I mean, without using the notion of the city on the hill, this had Reagan-esque sort of city on the hill, the John Winthrop notion all over the place. There's another point where he uses the word fire. And when I hear about fire in this regard, I'm thinking of the fire of Pentecost, in which God comes and inflames Jesus' disciples to go to all nations and to spread the good word. And I got the same sort of sense of what would be asked here is to go to all nations and spread the good word of freedom.
You know, the reference was the fire. It was a fire in the minds of men, freedom as a fire in the minds of men. And the first time that phrase was used, I've learned in the last 10 minutes on the web, was in The Possessed by Dostoevsky. And it was a character who was looking at a town that had been torched by revolutionaries. And he said, the fire is in the minds of men, not in the roofs of buildings. And I think that this was a very radical revolutionary speech.
Well, Joe Klein, in fact, Gail Chaddick from Christian Science Monitor told us earlier that she thought that there were a lot of veiled references and that the press is late in catching up with how often the president speaks to his core Christian constituents through his speeches without it being heard by other Americans. And I want to bring the professor in and ask, did you hear those as well?
I did. Look, you know, presidential references to God, though, are nothing new.
Right.
And it's a danger to make too much of what Bush does. I think the difference is kind of the Christian movement that has surrounded him in this inauguration is much more powerful than it has ever been historically. Back to the saber rattling, I just wanted to make one point. It is not that uncommon in wartime speeches to hear some kind of saber rattling. In the third inauguration speech of Franklin Roosevelt, I'm sure some of the same tone was there. The difference is there's very little talk of sacrifice. And I think that is something different that this administration has not stressed as much, meaning how citizens need to sacrifice something in a period of war. That was a central theme of Franklin Roosevelt, and Bush has been much more about tax cuts and giving people ownership rather than asking people to give of themselves.
Although he did nod to the soldiers, those who have given their lives in the war effort. Joe Klein, what else jumped out for you in the few minutes we have left?
Well, the thing that really jumped out for me was, as I listened to him, obviously this was a speech about foreign policy, domestic policy, total afterthought. But it jumped out to me that George Bush, who is my age, the oldest of the baby boomers, is a classic baby boomer. You know, he is a radical idealist, just as we thought we were 30 or 40 years ago. And a lot of this rhetoric, he referred to the rhetoric of the civil rights movement several times in this speech. You know, I wasn't put off or upset by the references to God, as one of the other guests just said. I mean, that's you know, business as usual. But the kind of militant idealism that he talked about, and the use of the word freedom. I mean, you know, back then we were talking about free love and free drugs, perhaps. But it was the same style of rhetoric. And in some ways, he is a creature of his generational zeitgeist.
We only have about a little under 2 minutes left. And I just wonder from each of you, is there a line that jumps out? I love the surround the lost with love. And there was another, which I can't find, about raising our hands to our hearts as one. But Professor, is there one that is going to resonate, or do we get to know that yet?
We won't get to know that for 10, 15 years until we see what happens in the second half of his presidency. I still think, and I'm probably unpopular, that the line about the public interest depends on private character can be very important if his second-term domestic policy agenda goes through. That could define kind of a new conservative era of government that focuses on the individual, not the public.
Jim Nuzzo?
Two quick lines. One is, and this goes to Joe's point, we cannot carry the message of freedom and the baggage of bigotry at the same time. And then he goes and basically says, we have confidence that freedom is the permanent hope of mankind, the hunger in dark places, the longing of the soul.
Joe?
Yeah, for me it's the fire references. First to 9/11, and then to freedom as a fire in the minds of men. And I kept on thinking, when you play with fire, you know, you might get burned.
Well, I'm speaking to Joe Klein, senior writer of Time Magazine. We've also been speaking all day with Julian Zelitzer, a history professor at Boston University, Jim Nuzzo, Republican strategist, in addition, Peter Greer from the Christian Science Monitor, his colleague Gail Chaddick, Andrea Stone from USA Today, Fred Tice here in Boston. We thank you all, and the tea leaves will continue to be parsed. Thank you all. Thanks so much. Joe, thanks.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thanks. And by the way, President Bush is having lunch. He must be wrapping up his lunch because in just a few minutes, the inaugural parade will begin. Look to see, does he get out of the car? And tune in tomorrow for more thoughts. This is Here and Now, a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.